Welcome to Beginner's Mind, an exploration through conversations that allow everyday people to see uncertainty as a space of discovery, growth, and acceptance. My name is Damaris Ferrer. I'm a movement educator helping people better understand the body-mind connection.
My name is Francisco Paco Lugo Viña. My Buddhist name is Genko Ji. I'm a Zen master helping people through their mental and spiritual constipations.
Yes, you heard that correct. Together, we offer guidance through our own personal stories by tapping into the human experiences we all share. Hello, Paco.
Hello, Damaris. Happy Friday, indeed. Indeed, indeed. So what are we dealing with today?
Today we're going to talk about housing, or I'd like to think of it as the home. Housing sounds so industrial or manufactured. I think the home is the conversation today. The two of us have had quite a few homes.
And I've been in the business of housing for over 40, 50 years, providing affordable housing in the South Bronx, picking up buildings that were abandoned, picking them up for a dollar from the city, rehabbed them, and had them inhabited by people from the neighborhood. So I've had some experience with that a little bit, and also did a project in Battery Park, which was a $40 million project, which gave me a sort of a understanding of the housing industry, particularly in an urban center like New York City. And I was married to a woman, Florence Wagner, who my daughter Leah is a good friend of yours, so it's almost your sister in many ways.
That's my sister.
It's your sister. And Florence was very much into housing. She came into the South Bronx as a VISTA volunteer, and she worked in housing. And from her perspective, pretty much like you, she thought that housing had been made it so plastic about the way they describe housing for the poor and the needy. And her position was, and you've mentioned this before, that she felt that housing was a birthright, mm-hmm. and that people needed to be able to be housed so that they could bring their family, so that they can become, they could have a culture, so that they could have a neighborhood. So it's a little bit, I have a little bit of experience in that area.
Yeah. When we talk about housing or a home, I kind of zoom in to like that one specific place, sort of like, what is the story? And a home, you know, in a city, a home is an apartment. It could be a brownstone. It could be an actual little house. It depends on, you know, anywhere. It depends on the landscape of where you live, right? What your home looks like. The meaning of home, or the use of the home, the importance of home for me is also about that it is a holding place. It becomes an archive. It becomes where stories are created, stories are gathered, are passed on, as well as things, right? Everybody who passes the home through the home, and in time, what that home accumulates, what we get rid of, things like that. Those tangible things. And when you lose your home, or when you move, but specifically when somebody loses their home for whatever reason, how do they carry, you know, like how do they carry their stuff, whether it's psychological or, right, how do they carry their stuff or their physical stuff? How much do people end up just letting go? Not necessarily because they want to, right? But out of necessity. And again, that could be tangible things or psychological things. It's like, just let it go because there's no other way to keep carrying these burdens when the housing situation is so precarious. And also, you know, going back to that apartment life in big cities, and what Florence believed, which is, you know, having a home as a birthright. At what point and who determined this? I guess has to, of course it has to do with real estate and, you know, who holds property. Who determined that from now on your family of five needs to live in one room? You know, it's like, well, who determined that? That's lousy, right? Or your family of five can have two rooms, but this is what it's going to cost you now. You know, I mean, that's where we've been. That's where we're at.
So housing, particularly in the urban areas, not sure about the suburban areas and the countryside, but has been governed by organizations like the Regional Planning Council in the city of New York. It's a powerful, it's a hidden government. Mm. Nobody's ever heard of the Regional Planning Council. Above the city council of the city of New York, above the city planning department of the city of New York, or all the towns around the Jersey City area, this council looks at the region and they make decisions. So Robert Moses, who was an incredible planner, had them under control. Mm. So he was able to say, you know, poor people ought to be put in federally subsidized housing projects. And it became a federal law, and therefore he was able to access that. And he built these monstrosities mm-hmm. that looked like jails. And HUD would originally build these as temporary housing, where places poor people would go and then graduate to go someplace else. It never happened. It never happened. So There are three, four generations of people living in these houses. To build these monstrosity, Robert Moses went around and destroyed what I choose to call natural neighborhoods. There were neighborhoods of Italian, of Irish, of Puerto Rican, like in El Barrio. There were these communities that share their cultural values that they bought from wherever they came from. And so they had these little communities in which a lot of families were present, and people just were very different about the way they behaved, about the way they took care of each other, about the way they took care of the kids. Those neighborhoods were also economic havens. What does that mean? It means that in a neighborhood, in order to prosper, the dollar spent has to revolve around that neighborhood about 2.5 times. So you go to the bodega guy, as you were saying before, he lives in the neighborhood. He spends money in the neighborhood. The flower place, the grocer, they're all part of the neighborhood. They don't live someplace very far away. So the fact that the dollar can revolve, or the spending can revolve 2.5 times, it makes a neighborhood flourish. That stopped. That stopped with the building of subsidized housing and public housing. And so those neighborhoods were destroyed. When he built the Cross Bronx Expressway, he wiped out a whole bunch of Italian neighborhoods that had been around that area. That has never recovered.
And I'll say that what you're describing, of course, you know, we're using New York because that's what also, you know, that's where you worked and that's where you lived and this is what you understand. But I think we agree that what you're saying, as far as the multicultural neighborhoods and the makeup of a neighborhood and the economic, you know, how the economics work in a neighborhood, is repeated in any urban, right? In Chicago, in New York, in all these big major cities, that has been the story, right? And then the destruction of that, right, through, you know, building these big highways and expressways and wiping out neighborhoods and not take, you know, what somebody thought was a good idea as far as, oh, this will be temporary. But really, the plan didn't go past that, right? The plan didn't go past that. I want to add also, as far as the mom pop shops, the things that I understand to be the building blocks and the cement of a community in a neighborhood, right? The barbershop, the pizza shop, the shoemaker, the bodega, the, you know, everything that makes a neighborhood hustle and bustle and people, right? When these big stores come in, you know, the Walmarts, and I guess as a plan, as far as everything you need as a one-stop shop was a good idea at the time. Those are community killers. For me, those are community killers.
So getting down to brass tacks and bringing it home, because we could talk about the history of planning board, planning associations, local planning boards, citywide planning organizations, the regional, we could talk about that and the politics of that. But what I'd like to talk about a little bit is about what did I do when I got a chance to build? Mm-hmm. What did I do? So one project I got, it was the Miramar project. It was two empty buildings, totally 75 apartments. And when we got that buildings from the city, there was empty lots behind the building. And my partner and I decided that we were going to do the first nationwide mixed development project, which meant that we were going to gut rehab the buildings. We're going to take them down, gut them. Mm-hmm. But we're going to build in the lots townhouses. Mm. Now, when we were talking about townhouses, since we were in charge with the developers, it was our piece of land, we got it from the city, we could decide what is it that we want to build there. So to your point before, we decided that we were going to build 4-bedroom townhouses. You can't build 4-bedroom townhouses. It's not economically good for the developer. You're not going to put more money into your pocket, bro. Why don't you build 1 or 2 bedrooms with a couple of efficiencies? We said, no. We're going to build for big families because big families are discriminated against, as you said before. So I built 8 townhouses, had 2 apartments per townhouse. There were 4 townhouses and 8 units, and each unit had 4 bedrooms. Every developer that I talked to said, you're out of your mind. You really don't want to make money. I said, no, I'll make plenty of money, and I did. So that was one instance. Mm-hmm. Those have been like godsends to those families that have been living there forever and ever. When it came to landscaping, the people said, listen, we got these little things that, you know, we could put little trees and little bushes. I said, no, I want trees. I want flowering trees because I want it to flower in the spring and be joyous in the spring. Well, those flowering trees, my friend, are going to be 2-year-old trees and 3-year-old trees. First of all, to transport them, you're going to have to pay more. Number two, to plant them, you're going to have to pay more. And it's coming out of your pocket. It's coming out of your development fee. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't care. So if you go to 149th Street and Colwell Avenue and you see the buildings and you go now in the spring, you see these gorgeous trees that flower. Mm-hmm. And you still have the families back there with four families because if they leave, they get rotated. So that's one thing that developers can do but won't do because the question is, if it comes out of my development fee, it comes out of my pocket,
then
I don't want to do
it. Right?
I don't do it. Anyway. I built another house. I took over a school, which I named after my mother, Villa Alejandrina, which Mayor Koch came to my opening. And which he said to my opening, Koch said, you know, you're more powerful than I am as mayor. I said, why? Why is that, Mr. Mayor? He said, because I can't name anything after my mother and you can. You know, and so it was a big school. It was a hard, gut job because the school was built like a brick house. I mean, it was a castle. And so what did I do? Because it had an entrance. It had a huge entrance that you came in and it was almost like a little majestic. So I said to the people who were doing the planning, I want gardens. I want beautiful gardens in that place. I want flowers. You can't put flowers in there. You can't. Do you know what's across the street from you? I said, yeah. It's a development project that one of my friends, a pastor from one of the Episcopal church, yeah, but it's drug addicts. The drug addicts are going to take your gardens and they're going to destroy it. I said, no, they're not. He said, how do you know? Because I knew. I knew differently. So when we built the thing up and we started putting the gardens, I went across the street and I started talking to people until I figured who the leadership was in that community of people who were living there with substance abuse challenges. And I said to them, this is what I want to do. I want to put beautiful gardens across the street because you guys deserve it. And my people in here, which are your people, deserve it. And this is your task. I want you to watch over those gardens. I want you to make sure that nobody destroys them. Man, you got it. Man, you got it. You know, nobody's going to touch those flowers. I said, and once in a while, if there's a huge bouquet of flowers and you need to cut a few for your mom or something, you could go ahead. It's your garden. Nobody, no one destroyed that garden for years and years
because
and years.
Because you gave it to them.
I gave it to them.
Because you have to, if you're building for the community, they need to know that it is theirs, right? Because you are giving it to them. People go into these new communities or whatever, low income, you know, housing as a guest, right? As a guest. You can't do this, 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 you can't do this. These are the rules. This is how you get kicked out. This is how you get kicked out. This is how you get kicked out, right? Everything is, it's like little kids, you know, when you raise a small child and the only word they know is no. No, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this, don't do, right? There's a programming there, right? Nothing is yours. You have no autonomy. You have no responsibility to take care of anything because it's not yours. The language is very different. You were very clear about the flowers. Yes, help yourself to the flowers. That's why the flowers are there, right? And also in a place up north, the flowers go away in the winter. Mm-hmm. And when they return, mm-hmm. they are for everybody.
Yeah.
It's just a different message.
So as an example, I don't know how much money I spend on bulbs because I used to like to have bulbs in the garden so that early spring, that's the first thing that came out. Mm-hmm. And the teardrops were the first ones. The little tiny bulbs like this, and they're the first ones to come out. So I went across the street. I said, listen, guys, I'd like you to help me plant the bulbs. You know, and you, each one of you know where your bulbs are. I used that trick many times before and after. And so they planted the bulbs, and they knew exactly where they had planted the bulbs, and I gave them different kinds of bulbs. That was, again, ownership and seeing.
Involvement.
And involvement and things like that, you know. One of the things that happened with my project was that at that era, it was what they call Section 8. And Section 8 came in two classes. One, a person went and applied to the city of New York, and the Section 8 was a federal program, and applied for a Section 8 certificate. And then they went to landlords that were open to accepting Section 8 people, and the landlords would cream. The landlords would interview. The landlords would go to the people's houses and all of that stuff. Mine were federal Section 8. The difference was that no one came to me with a certificate. They applied for an apartment as the building was being built up. I had a list of people that qualified, and the way they qualified was through their income. Not only the fact that they may have government help, but one person in the family might be working, or two people might be working. So they had to come and bring their income, and we verify their income to be able to qualify. And then once they qualified, we put them in a hat, and they were picked by lottery. So I had no choice. I had no choice as to who was going to be the tenants
right.
in the building. That was good, and that was also had negative aspects. Mm-hmm. One of the negative aspects was that some of the people who had come to my buildings, particularly would come out of the lottery, were people who were not that used to being responsible mm-hmm. for living in a building
right.
like that. They have come from real slums and things like that. And so one of my managers said, listen, I'm already having problems with the plumbing. I said, what's the plumbing? He said, it's gotten stuck the last 2 months. I said, why? He said, you know, some people, not all, but some people throw down this toilet, things that shouldn't be done in the toilet. I said, let's have a meeting of the entire population in that building. That was in Miramar Court. And so I had a meeting. And he said, what are you going to tell them? Are you going to tell them what is the responsibility of living in a building and what can go into the toilet or not? He said, well, you know, you're going to get into trouble. I said, I'm not going to get into trouble. So I went and I met with everyone. And I told them, we've had now two incidences of plumbing
backing up.
And so let's go through the situation. And anybody who feels offended, hey, talk to me. Talk to me and talk to me in front of everybody. Don't go behind my back afterwards and say, you know, este está discriminando, que este que lo otro, you know, because they were mostly after Puerto Ricans. So I said, and I told them, I said, so let's start with baby diapers. do not go in the toilet. Women's pads that they need badly on a monthly basis do not go in the bathroom. I would say it to them, mm-hmm. you know, and I went through the whole thing and I said, there are a lot of things that don't go there, you know, paper towels, y busqué un montón de cosas, right? I said, because they'll mess up the plumbing and everybody's going to suffer. So I want some discussion. There was discussion. No, que son otra gente que no están impuestos a vivir con gente. These are people who are uncivilized. I said, wait. Let's stop here. There's no uncivilized people here. Everybody who's here is deserving of this apartments, no matter where you came from. So one of the things that we're not going to do is point fingers, because that's bad business. And so I got them talking to each other. Before you know it, they were all talking. And one lady says, Mr. Lugoviña, may I put my hand? Sure. What is your name? My name is Saul. What apartment are you? 3, I'm a 4C. I'm probably one of the culprits. And everybody goes, silence. She said, I didn't know you couldn't put baby diapers down mm-hmm. there.
Communication. Sometimes you just have to communicate.
So she broke the ice mm-hmm. because she felt safe to mm-hmm. do that, because mm-hmm. I set the conditions so that nobody was going to get messed up. Mm-hmm. Before you know it, there were 3 other people who said, I'm with her. I did the same thing. You know, and I also do throw other things that I'm not going to talk about because that's private to us ladies, that kind of thing. My plumbing problem stopped through communication. Right. ¿Entiende? So it was those kinds of things, in my opinion, that those buildings were great, 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 great buildings. And I could go on about stories of those buildings, some not so good and some good. But 99% of my tenants were all good. And they took care of the apartment. When they left the apartment better than I gave it to them. You know, there were some who messed up the apartments and stuff like that. There's always that kind of situation.
Yeah.
So that's the development piece. That's the communication piece. In those buildings, people began to help each other, help the elderly, because the elders were also in my buildings. You know, they were not discriminated against in the lottery. So I had elder people in my buildings.
Yeah.
And so people began to help with shopping. Those buildings became communities.
Community, there you go.
Yeah. Those buildings
going back to community.
They became community.
You know, if there were more landlords and developers, obviously, like you, that are not scared or don't feel, you know, sort of apprehensive of entering a community in a real way, right, where you can just speak to people, communicate, give people responsibility, you know, and understanding. You know, a lot of people, when they were younger, especially when you're from the Caribbean, you live in a house. You live in una casita. And some people, yeah, living in a building, you think that whatever you're doing in your apartment is private, and you have no idea that something as simple as putting stuff in the toilet is affecting your neighbor downstairs, your neighbor to the right. You don't know until you know. And so civilized communication, as simple as that may sound, for some people, it just doesn't occur to them to just have a civilized conversation. And how much that connects people, how much that just brings everybody into community. Just communicate.
Yeah, there was a place in the Bronx, which was a place that the landlords had burned all the buildings and the city had destroyed all the buildings and demo. So with this huge piece of land, I can't remember whether it was 15 acres, 20 acres, but it was huge. And so the city wanted to build more housing projects and other things. I was the one that led with other people the opposition to the housing projects. And they wanted to build big towers. And we fought them, we picketed, we did all the things that we needed to do. And they said, well, what kind of housing do you want? We want single occupancy housing. Single occupancy housing? You're not taking care of the density issue. This is an urban center. This is an urban area. You need to put as many people in the least square footage as you can. So you need to build up. I said, no, you don't. You can do this. And so we fought them. And we finally got all the 3 planning boards, because it were like 3 planning boards, to agree that we were going to do single family housing. And the city was livid. I forgot who the mayor was. And so we went to the state, we went to the federals, and we got funding to do single family housings. We then proceeded to do a 3-way interviewing of people who were with us, And ultimately, to make the story short, because I can't remember the whole process that we went through, it was very, very complicated. We ended up hiring a guy from Boston by the name of Ed Logue. And Ed Logue had been famous in Massachusetts because he built Faneuil Hall in the waterfront in Massachusetts. He was the one that did that. And he also was famous because in New Haven, the New Haven Development Project, which Yale University was very much involved, Ed Logue was a planner. So we said, what if we get Ed Logue to come here? And they said, you never get Ed Logue to come to the South Bronx. He's too famous. He already has done his thing. So we reach out to Ed Logue. He says, sure, I'll come down. I got nothing else to do. I'm hanging out in Martha's Vineyard, not doing anything. I don't have any problem. I'll come down. So he comes down and he cuts a deal that he wanted $10,000 a month, which was cheap. Even at that time, we built close to, I believe was, I mean, I may be totally wrong about the number, but it was over 125 single family homes with big yards, which drove the city crazy because we said they deserve to have a nice piece of land. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know, 40, 50 years later, those houses are worth $600,000-$800,000, and they bought them for $56,000. And those people stay with it. They develop a community. They develop a community. The shopping areas around where those houses are all thrived.
Which is where?
It's right in the middle of the Bronx. So it's near Intervale, that area off Crotona Avenue. And for the life of me, because I'm old and I didn't think I was going to go in that direction, I can't remember the name of the project. But this is a project that was done in a place that had been visited by two U.S. presidents. I think Reagan visited, Carter visited, because it was a wild land. These 15 acres were wild.
This is where the buildings were burning.
And there were gangs there, yeah. You know. In fact, I did a movie there. I didn't do a movie. One of the big comedians did a movie. The name of the movie was called Wolfen. And it was about this werewolf. And they went and they built this building and church and everything else. They built structures, but the gangs were coming in and taking some of the equipment and stuff like that. So I was hired to protect the equipment and the stuff. That's for another day. Another day, remind me to tell you the story.
That's another story.
That's another story. I'm not going to take you there. But I did end up getting the contract and creating the conditions for protecting the crew and the film setting and stuff like that. But that's an interesting story, worth all by itself at some other point. Yeah. But where that property was, that's where the housing was built. Yeah.
Well, what you're talking about, just kind of bringing us back, is that home and community, meaning homes, housing, the system that creates community does work. It does work. Despite what other people say, you can't do it that way, you shouldn't do it that way, you're not going to make money, this is not going to work, this is not going to help, this is not going to benefit anybody. And you have proven through your projects, time and time again, it sounds like, that yes, it does work. You know, where there's a will, there's a way, but where there's an understanding of what a real community needs and how they thrive and how to support families in the long haul does work.
Yeah, and these families that got these homes had to be able to have the qualifications to be able to get a mortgage mm-hmm. for $51,000, $52,000. And we did get the mortgages. We facilitated the financing with very, very low down payment. Now, the naysayers said, these people don't know how to live in a home. These people, with all that land, what are they going to do with all that land? They don't know what to do. Well, if you go there now, you find the most incredible landscaping, mm-hmm. very creative landscaping. And different than here in Florida, where landscaping in some of the projects have to be uniform, they have to be, everyone did their thing. There are different ones. And as the landscaping mature, there's this cacophony of shrubberies and trees and things like that. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful. It's beautiful. Yeah. So they did take care of their homes. Yes, they did plant. And yes, they wanted to make their homes unique and different than the other homes.
Yeah. They're little heaven in a big city.
Little heavens. I don't think that we had basements in those houses. So it was lab on grade. It was almost like the houses here in Florida. But that was a major success. A major success where density, you know, was lower so to the single family. I think it's probably in the only single family development in an urban setting in New York City in the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's ever been done before, again, after we did that. So the outcome of that is that, you know, I don't know what that is, but what a study that would be to really take a look at the families that moved there. What happened to their children? How did their children grow? Where did they go? I would not be surprised if there's huge amount of success stories coming out of that thing. Because to me, the crime that gets attributed to urban centers like the South Bronx, I always opine that living in a housing project was almost like living in jail. Mm-hmm. That they were almost preparing some of those kids to go to Rikers Islands where they were gonna go. Right. Because the hallways are thin. I mean, it's horrible, horrible, horrible. Yeah. Any rate, I'm not sure where we're going with all of this stuff, but certainly I think housing rights is still an issue. From San Francisco, where homeless people are still living out in the streets, and New York City, where there are now 65,000 people who are categorized as homeless.
Again, every urban center, downtown, downtown Fort Lauderdale, Miami, Seattle is terrible.
People don't, the planners don't have any answers to that, but I'm sure that people who are creative, particularly the artist community, can come up with very creative kinds of things out of, but the planners that went to school to do urban planning and stuff like that, they just don't know how to do it. They were thinking structures, systems, and as you like to say, they were not thinking
humans.
Cooking it at home. I tell a story that once I used to look at my plans, and it was in Villa Alejandrina, no, it was in Miramar Court. I looked at the plans, and because I like cooking, the first thing that I usually used to use, we look at the kitchen. And I look at the plans, and I said, there's something wrong with the kitchens. And they said, what? I said, the wall between the stove and pantry is too short. We went too short. I said, if you get one of these big mamas, Puerto Rican ladies, big ladies, or one of our black ladies coming in, they're never going to be able to bend down to open the oven. And sure enough, we took a look at that, and we had to revise the entire plans because the guys who did the kitchens had never done kitchens before. I mean, these were architects coming out of school or whatever, mm-hmm. and they had no idea what went on in the kitchen. So there were things like that that had to happen. But as you said, you had to have a sense of caring of who you were building the houses for and what kind of community you were trying to build. I still have hope that some of those things in the coming years are going to be remedied, including the whole housing issue with the homeless population. We stopped calling them homeless. We started calling them people without an address, you know, because you pointed out before that sometimes we pick derogatory language in code to marginalize people, even in language, right. which ultimately dictates policy.
Right. And when you don't have an address, no one knows where you are. You don't know where you are. You can't receive anything. You can't fill out forms. You can't receive a check. You can't, you have no address. You have no.
Although I tell you, as a Zen Buddhist priest, I've lived in the street. And your mom has been in the streets with me sometimes for a week. And we used to do it during Holy Week. And one of the things that we found out was that some of the people in the streets definitely suffer from what you described. But a lot of the people in the street had P.O. boxes.
Oh, yes.
A lot of people in the streets were veterans. Mm-hmm. And they got checks. And so they had P.O. boxes. Some of the people in the streets, when they got their checks, they went into a hotel and they got a hotel room and they bathed and they had a great time with their check and then they went back out on the street. Right. So there was a whole cultural thing that none of us really, really understood.
Right, yeah. And again, I think this is for another conversation because this is another rabbit hole, but how do these two things live in the same sentence? A veteran with a P.O. box, because the veteran fighting for our country has no home.
That's a huge, huge conversation that we can bring a lot of veterans associations to talk with us and stuff like that.
That because, makes no sense. Yeah, that right there.
You know,
makes no
sense. You can go to you can go to the veterans hospital conversation, and that's it. I mean, we could talk about that earlier. But lots of, you know, Larry. We used to call him Batman. Now he's living in Georgia. And the reason we call him Batman is because if you look at one of the Batman movies, the Batman mobile comes around a corner, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden a homeless person jumps up. When they were filming that, he was sleeping up there. He jumped up to see what was that whole going on. And they said, cut, 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 cut. And then the guy said, no, let's do it again. But tell that guy over there, pay him some money. Tell him to jump up again. So he's in the movie.
That's great.
Yeah. Larry Chambers, that's his name. We still talk to him. This is a good conversation, and it's certainly a conversation that has a lot of legs, mm-hmm. and we could keep talking about this for a long, long, long time. But I think the solution is more in the neighborhood of that if the developers do not have the consciousness to, out of their pockets, do what's right in building what is called affordable housing, then policy has to say that community gardens have to be part of development and or whatever, you know. Right. And I'm using community gardens because I believe that's part of the spirit that keeps people healthy, mm-hmm. and children healthy. To see, particularly in the North, where, as you said, things go to sleep during the winter and they come back and rebirth, yeah. in the spring, you know. So anyway, good conversation, Damaris.
Very good, Paco. Thank you.
Thank you.